The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Dear friends, I want to welcome all of you to the Washington College of Law's second annual lecture on international commercial arbitration. I'm Claudio Grossman, the Dean of the Law School. We developed the international arbitration program in 2004 under the able direction of Horacio Grigera Naon, former Secretary General of the ICC International Court of Arbitration, with the purpose of analyzing the practical and theoretical issues surrounding the development of international commercial arbitration and contributing to the task of better understanding this phenomenon. The program prepares the legal profession to face these new challenges through a series of initiatives, but centers in particular in three events, annual events. The International Commercial Arbitration Summer Session, the annual seminar on international commercial arbitration, and the annual lecture on international commercial arbitration. The strategic vision of the law school is that we need to address important issues facing the community, the nation, and the world, and serve the profession. And we have thought that commercial arbitration is key for the practice of the profession, for the promotion of important values, to strengthen the rule of law everywhere. And we thought then that encouraging and developing this program was essential. Before Horacio Grigera Naon introduces our renowned guest speaker, I want also to take a moment to offer special thanks to Thelen Reed Brown Riesman and Steiner LLP for sponsoring this year's annual lecture. We live in a different situation in the law school than was the past. In the past, law school will be the only institutions doing research and storing the results of their research in libraries, and the only ones doing training. Well, that's not the case any longer. There are many institutions in society that engage in similar endeavors, and again, we have seen as part of the strategic development of this institution to form partnership with entities that want to achieve similar goals. And from that perspective, we are very grateful to Thelen, which, as you know, is an international law firm with offices throughout the globe. We want to particularly recognize two partners in the international arbitration practice of Thelen, Michael Jaffe and Ronan McHugh. I think Michael is not here, Ronan is here, and then we are pleased to have Thelen interest and support in the idea of international commercial arbitration, and we look forward to continue to do exciting program. We are thrilled that they have contributed and supported this year's annual lecture, and we look forward, as I mentioned, to a continued collaboration with them and with other law firms in the region, as we work towards enhancing our academic activities in arbitration and creating new opportunities for our students and alumni. So, Ronan, will you come here? We want to give you a small token of appreciation and thank you for your contribution. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. This is a very entrepreneurial school, and in our quest to continue to create opportunities, we will imagine different ways again to link institutions in the society that will allow to pursue our mission. Allow me now to introduce the director of the International Arbitration Program at our law school, Dr. Horacio Grigera Naon. Dr. Grigera Naon is an independent international arbitrator and consultant on business and international law matters. He is a former Secretary General of the International Court of Arbitration, of the International Chamber of Commerce, and has been a practitioner in the field of international commercial arbitration and international business law for over 25 years. We were fortunate to attract Horacio Grigera Naon to direct our program on commercial arbitration. He brought the terrific ideas and leadership to this important program. And in addition to his extensive practice, he is one of the most important contributors to the theory and practice of this field. So we're honored to have you here, Horacio, and without further ado, I welcome you to the podium. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dean Grossman. It is my great pleasure to introduce Julian Liu, QC, to this audience of colleagues and friends. Julian Liu is so well known in the area of international commercial arbitration that I do not think that much is needed to introduce him. But in any case, I would like to say that Julian is a barrister and Queen's Counsel with Essex Chambers in London. Since 1985, he has been a visiting professor and head of the School of International Arbitration, Center for Commercial Law Studies, Queen Mary University, London, UK. He is one of the most able and distinguished international arbitrators of our times. He has acted as arbitrator under every possible institutional or ad hoc arbitration system or rules that you can imagine. But in addition to that, he has been active as a lawyer and an advocate, as a counsel, former partner with Herbert Smith, based in London. And in addition to that, he has extensively published in the area of international arbitration, before and after his seminal book of 1978 on applicable law and international arbitration. Julian has contributed extensively to the area with academic writings of high standing. I would like to close this introduction without a personal note. I know Julian since the beginning of our careers, just a few years ago. We have been living in different countries, and we have been geographically distant, but we have been always very close to each other, spiritually, and also because of our common interest in international commercial arbitration. And I am very happy to come here among my friends. So Julian, please.
Thank you, Horacio. Dean Grossman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation to come. And the honor is for several reasons. First of all, it's always a pleasure and an honor to work together with Horacio Grigera. He says that we've known one another a long time. In fact, my recollection is that we first met in New Delhi in 1974, attending the International Law Association meeting there. Actually, neither of us were attending. I was there in a student capacity, and he was there carrying the bags of Professor Margarita Arguas, a very distinguished and lovely Argentinian professor and judge of the Supreme Court in that country. And we've known one another since then. And of course, our first love for both of us was private international law, which is where we started. And surprisingly, we moved into the area of arbitration. And the second reason I'm delighted to be here is to be at Washington College. And this, in a way, is a tribute to Horacio and to Dean Grossman. What you've done here in a few years in the arbitration area is remarkable. We started the School of International Arbitration in London in 1985. And our reputation has been built with hard work and with many programs. It's wonderful to see another institution that is following in the same line. We teach different kinds of programs, but it's fantastic for me to see this type of activity. And I do really admire and commend the efforts that have been made by Horacio and his colleagues here in developing these programs. And thirdly, I would want to pay tribute to Thalen Reed, Brown, Raisman and Steiner. It's a firm that I've known of for many years, I know Jerry Axon extremely well, and I'm honored, actually, to have the opportunity of giving this lecture the year after he gave the inaugural lecture. As I start, let me give a health warning. I'm known at the School of International Arbitration in London for asking questions. I'm equally known for not being too good at answering them. It's easier that way. I'm not sure I'll be greatly different this evening, but let's see how we go. My lecture this evening is entitled, Does National Court Involvement Undermine the International Arbitration Process? That's a question, but here's another one. Who owns and controls the international arbitration process? There are four obvious candidates. The tribunal, the relevant national law and the courts, the parties, or the lawyers. This is a crucial question in the context of the role of national courts when faced with a matter which is subject to an arbitration agreement. Who brings the case to court? Who decides the court is preferable to arbitration? Why has it been brought to a court? What are the issues? What can and should the court do in the face of a valid arbitration agreement? The specific question, who owns and controls an international arbitration, is for another day. Put it in your pocket, Horacio. Use it for another discussion. It may be uncomfortable for lawyers who so often decide tactically to follow certain procedures and for other motives than because a specific matter should be properly in the courts. But for tonight, it's a fact of life that despite the existence of arbitration agreements, national courts do become involved with international arbitration. Why? Well, because we invite them. We encourage them. We induce them to become involved. The possibility of national court involvement depends on the national law of that country. I'm not going to look at when national courts can get involved specifically. This evening, I propose to look at the areas where courts do become involved, and specifically at four areas. Firstly, the fundamental characteristics of international arbitration and its coexistence with national courts. The different stages of court involvement, the forms of court involvement, and then a major part of this presentation will be a review of court injunctions in support of the arbitration process. And then perhaps we can try and attempt to see if we can reach a conclusion on the big question. So let me turn to my main question, my first question this evening. What are the main characteristics of international arbitration? I suggest there are four. First, and I've argued this elsewhere, international arbitration has an autonomous character. It exists in a domain independent of and separate from national laws and jurisdictions. Arbitration does not, as some have suggested, operate solely on the basis of a contract or from the relinquishment of jurisdiction by states, or even a combination of both. Rather, arbitration is an autonomous system with a life of its own. It inhabits a domain that is wholly outside any system of national law. Contract and the relinquishment of court jurisdiction may be the basis at which access is obtained to this international arbitration domain. But once one has entered that, and subject to the controls that we'll discuss a little later, arbitration exists in its own rarefied domain. The second characteristic is that by their choice of arbitration, parties have expressed a positive selection of an alternative dispute resolution system. This is so even when national law has been chosen as the substantive law of the contract. More specifically, the parties have intentionally and expressly rejected the jurisdiction of national courts. They may have done so for various reasons. National courts being unacceptable to them, unsuitable for their contract, inappropriate in the circumstances of the case. What they've agreed to is that the courts should take a back seat. The question is how far back and when do the courts come forward? Third characteristic is this. The arbitral tribunal has primary responsibility for determining all matters relating to the dispute between the parties. Only rarely will this not be the case. Through the principles of separability, the agreement to arbitrate is able to survive even when the underlying agreement is in some doubt and even when it is found to be invalid or illegal. Through the principle of competence, the arbitral tribunal is entitled, if not duty-bound, to determine its own jurisdiction. And the fourth characteristic is this. Despite the autonomous nature of arbitration, we must recognize that just as no man or woman is an island, so no dispute resolution system can exist in a vacuum. Without prejudice to autonomy, international arbitration does regularly interact with national jurisdictions for its existence to be legitimated and for support, help, and effectiveness. The assistance of national courts takes on different forms at different stages, and we'll review some of those in a few moments. But in this overall scheme, the tentacles of international arbitration can be envisaged as those of the giant squid who seeks nourishment from the murky oceanic world where, in our analogy, the domain of international arbitration and national jurisdictions meet. One might therefore talk of the international arbitration process stretching its tentacles down from the domain of international arbitration into the national legal system to forage for legitimacy, support, recognition, and effectiveness. My second question: what are the areas and types of court involvement? Taking those four characteristics as a backdrop, it seems that the first place to look, as always with international arbitration, is the New York Convention. That set down the framework within which everything should be considered. This provides, variously, that each contracting state must recognize an agreement in writing under which the parties undertake to submit to arbitration. It requires contracting states, when dealing with a case where there is a valid arbitration agreement, if requested by one of the parties, to refer the parties to arbitration, provided the arbitration agreement is not null and void, inoperative, or incapable of being performed. It requires that each contracting state, when dealing with a case, in respect of which there is a valid arbitration agreement, must recognize arbitral awards as binding and enforce them. And fourthly, the convention provides that the court at the place where enforcement of an award is sought, can refuse recognition and enforcement of such an award only in specified limited circumstances. A close reading of the New York Convention leads to two relevant crucial principles of international arbitration. First, court involvement is required as a support for the arbitral process, and recognition and enforcement of arbitral agreements and awards, but nothing else. In this context, any other national court involvement is illegitimate. This would include actions to protect nationals in a particular country, to intimidate arbitrators, to protect national commercial and jurisdictional interests, or simply, as is probably the case most frequently, because the court, the national court, thinks that it is better suited than an arbitral tribunal to decide a particular issue. Second, the only courts that should become involved with the arbitration process are those at the seat of the arbitration and at the place of enforcement. It is here, as we will see later, in the context of the use of anti-suit and anti-arbitration injunctions, that the intervention of the courts conflicts with these accepted international rules. Let me mention also briefly the antitrust model law. This, as you know, records what are generally considered the standards and practices of international arbitration. It contains similar provisions to the New York Convention, perhaps slightly more expansive. Its approach is clearly stated right out of the outset. Article 5 says, no court shall intervene except where so provided in this law. And Article 6 then designates just three areas for court involvement. Firstly, it provides for court assistance to ensure the proper appointment of a tribunal where the appointing mechanism fails, where there is a challenge to the independence and impartiality of an arbitrator, or an arbitrator becomes incapable of performing his or her duties. Secondly, it gives the court the power to revisit issues concerning the tribunal's jurisdiction in light of the terms of the arbitration agreement. And thirdly, it provides for certain exceptional conditions where the court may set aside an award. Of course, it also provides similar language as in the New York Convention for enforcement. But that's a different issue to the question of the courts being involved. But I repeat, it makes no provision other than those three areas for national courts to be involved with the arbitration process. My third question. At what stage can and do courts become involved? Well, I suggest there are three, or there are four. Prior to the establishment of the tribunal, at the commencement of the arbitration, during the arbitration, and the fourth, during the enforcement stage. Prior to the establishment of the tribunal, the courts get involved in two situations. A party has brought a case to a court, despite there being an arbitration agreement. Or secondly, one of the parties goes to a court to seek urgent protection, which cannot await the establishment of a tribunal. In both cases, properly exercised, the court's duty is to uphold the agreement to arbitrate. In the first case, the court must deal with this in accordance with the New York Convention, refer the matter to arbitration. In the second case, the court must fill the gap until a tribunal is established to protect the status quo. At the commencement of the arbitration, court intervention generally involves assisting with the appointment of and challenge to arbitrators. As we saw reflected in the answer trial model law, you find similar provisions in most national laws. The court here uses authority, why? To give effect to the party's agreement, to establish an appropriate tribunal to take over and deal with the dispute between the parties in the areas prescribed in the arbitration agreement. Third, during the arbitration process, court involvement comes in many forms and is really dealt with in arbitration statutes. Properly exercised, it involves courts making orders of a purely procedural nature that cannot be ordered or enforced by arbitrators, or orders for maintaining the status quo. These orders are invariably very helpful. Finally, at the enforcement stage, we now have an arbitration award. And here there are two options and two places where the courts would get involved. One, at the place or the seat of arbitration, where there is a wish to challenge an award, to seek it to be set aside, or even to appeal against it, if that's what the arbitration regime allows. And secondly, in another place where one looks to enforce the award, where the party seeking to enforce wishes to ask the courts to give effect to the award. One word of caution in all of this. We consider these principles as outlined acceptable, perhaps even normal and desirable. But we must be aware that when a national court is asked to deal with any of these issues, it is in its simplest form a negation of the arbitration agreement. More particularly, a national court will inevitably and unsurprisingly approach and determine these issues in accordance with its own national law and procedures. More controversially, it may be influenced by its own parochial, legal, cultural, economic, and political system. My fourth question. When should courts issue an injunction in connection with an arbitration? This is one area of court involvement which crosses the cut every stage of the arbitration process, and it gives rise to a number of practical and conceptual difficulties. And for that reason, I will focus for the majority of the rest of the time of this lecture on that area. Its importance is such, Judge Schwebel said, described it as one of the gravest problems of contemporary international commercial arbitration. Of course, injunctions come in all shapes and sizes. I'm going to focus on those which seek to undermine or block the arbitration proceedings, and those which encourage and enforce arbitration proceedings. And I propose to look separately at anti-arbitration injunctions, anti-suit injunctions, and pro-arbitration injunctions. Firstly, anti-arbitration injunctions. Now, these are used either before the arbitration has commenced to prevent the tribunal being established, or after proceedings have begun to stop an arbitration in its tracks. These injunctions can be directed against the parties, or against the arbitrators, or even against the arbitration institution where there is one. Now, when looking at these injunctions, there is a distinction between common law countries and civil law countries when it comes to the power to award anti-arbitration injunctions. Common law countries tend to be permissive and therefore more willing to get involved. Civil law countries tend to be restrictive and are reluctant to interfere in the process chosen by the parties. This is not surprising, as at the risk of gross exaggeration and simplification in describing these two systems, the common law generally deals with parallel proceedings on a case-by-case basis by way of forum non conveniens. Civil law systems use the lis alibi pendens principle, first come, first served, and therefore do not intervene very much. And we'll see an example of that a little later. Now, looking at the common law countries, an example in the English is that the English courts rely on two statutory provisions as giving them the power to award injunctions in the arbitration context. And this authority was applied in the Wellex case, where an anti-suit injunction was issued restraining one of the parties from proceeding with court proceedings in Poland brought in violation of an arbitration agreement. English courts can award anti-arbitration injunctions, but in fact will only do so in exceptional circumstances, and specifically only where it is clear that the arbitration proceedings have been wrongly brought. An interesting case was the Weissfisch and Julius case, where an action was brought in the English courts seeking, firstly, a declaration that an arbitration agreement providing for Swiss law and a Swiss arbitral seat was void, and an injunction restraining a sole arbitrator under the agreement from acting as arbitrator and proceeding with the arbitration. The only real connection bringing this arbitration to England was the fact that the arbitrator was an English lawyer and therefore within the jurisdiction of the English court. The application was rejected on several grounds, but in particular, the arbitration agreement states expressly that disputes should be resolved by a sole arbitrator with his seat in Switzerland and governed by Swiss law. Therefore, any issues as to the validity of the arbitration agreement, said the English court, must be resolved in Switzerland according to Swiss law. This was not a matter for the English courts to get involved with. I understand that it is well established that the United States courts have a general power to grant anti-suit and anti-arbitration injunctions. Before a court may grant an anti-suit injunction, there are three threshold requirements. The court must have jurisdiction. The parties to the both proceedings, arbitration and litigation, or both pieces of litigation, must be the same. And the decision in the action before the court issuing the injunction must dispose of the foreign court proceedings. Once these requirements have been met, the standard applied issuing an anti-arbitration injunction varies depending upon the court for which the injunction was sought. I understand there are different approaches of the US courts of appeal, and I won't attempt to explore them here. Suffice it to say that in each particular case, the onus is on persuading the court that in light of the particular circumstances of the case, including the nature of the actions and the policies at stake, the case is suitable for an anti-suit or an anti-arbitration injunction. By contrast, not surprisingly, anti-arbitration injunctions are incompatible with the Swiss legal system. In a recent case of Air Pty against IATA, the courts in Geneva ruled that an anti-suit injunction, including anti-arbitration injunctions, are contrary to Swiss law. And the court said, as a matter of Swiss law, there is no such thing as a judicial tutelage of the courts over arbitrators. Quite to the contrary, Swiss law fully implements the principle of competens, both in its positive effect and in its negative effect. It appears in France that it is generally possible to obtain an order to discontinue proceedings before a foreign court under Article 1458 of the French Civil Code, which applies to both domestic and international arbitrations. If a dispute pending before an arbitral tribunal on the basis of an arbitration agreement is brought before a state court, the court shall declare itself incompetent. It makes it absolutely clear. It is for the tribunal in the first instance to determine the validity and extent of the arbitration agreement. The role of the court is limited to reviewing the arbitrator's award on jurisdiction at the annulment stage or at the enforcement stage. Well, the next question is one of principle. Should national courts grant anti-arbitration injunctions? In my view, there will hardly ever be a justification for a national court to grant an anti-arbitration injunction of the kind we've discussed. Firstly, the principle of competens, separability, and party autonomy all point to the overarching principle that a decision as to whether or not an arbitration should continue should be left first and foremost to the arbitration tribunal. Second, and I've already referred to this, the plain reading of the model law, and remember its importance in the current position, the current views of international arbitration, makes it absolutely clear, in matters governed by this law, no court shall intervene except where so provided by the law. And the law makes no provision for anti-suit or anti-arbitration injunctions. Thirdly, only the court of the seat of arbitration has jurisdiction with respect to an arbitration, and it should exercise this only in very limited circumstances. There can be little justification for the court of the seat of arbitration preventing challenge of an award outside the seat by injunction, and we'll look at a couple of cases on that a little later. Fourthly, although it is argued that anti-arbitration injunctions do sometimes serve just ends, this may only be after lengthy and costly parallel litigation in various fora. Some of you will be aware of the General Electric Dirtz case, where a U.S. court granted an anti-arbitration injunction to stop an arbitration abroad. This was after lengthy arguments and attempts by both parties to obtain anti-arbitration injunctions. Fifthly, abuse is most likely when a party approaches its own court for assistance, and that court is not the seat of arbitration. Interestingly, in ICC statistics, 22 out of 31 cases where anti-arbitration injunctions were granted, these were granted by the courts of the nationality of one of the parties. Matters become particularly suspicious when one party is a state or state entity which seeks and obtains an injunction from its own state courts. There have been several unfortunate cases of this kind. The Himperna case. Infamous it is. Of an Indonesian court issuing an anti-arbitration injunction to stop an arbitral tribunal from rendering award against an Indonesian state-owned corporation. The Salini case is another example where the courts of the state party, in this case Ethiopia, obtained an injunction to stop arbitration proceedings which were taking an unfavorable turn for the state party. The arbitration had its seat in Ethiopia, but the arbitrators had decided, for convenience, to hold hearings in Paris. In the Hupco case, again, the state party to an arbitration agreement obtained from the courts of its country an order to prevent an arbitration from proceeding. The dispute arose out of a power purchasing agreement concluded with a Pakistani state-owned company. The Supreme Court of Pakistan had to decide which of two anti-suit injunctions to uphold, one that had been brought by the party restraining the other one from arbitration, and the other, the anti-arbitration injunction, which had been brought by the Pakistan State Company. Supreme Court of Pakistan held that the only question to be decided was whether the dispute was arbitrable. It then went ahead, ignoring doctrine of separability and competence, and decided that. It decided by a majority that the matters raised were not arbitrable because they involved matters of criminality. And therefore it decided to maintain the injunction that Hupco must desist from the London arbitration and bring its claim before the courts of Pakistan. And similarly, in the SGS against Pakistan case, the Pakistan Supreme Court issued an anti-arbitration injunction restraining SGS from taking any step, action or measure to pursue or participate in an exit in arbitration. This arbitration had been brought on the basis of the Pakistan-Switzerland bilateral investment treaty. It's worth noting that in these, or in most of these cases, despite the anti-arbitration orders, the tribunals refused to be intimidated and did continue with their work. Finally, even if an award might eventually be set aside or enforcement refused by the competent court, the anti-arbitration injunction negates the process by which this is supposed to take place. This is well illustrated by a recent English case in which an application was made to an English court for an injunction restraining an arbitration being pursued in Malaysia. The applicant relied on there being an oral underlying agreement subject to English law. It acknowledged that there was a written agreement which contained an arbitration clause and which had been signed by the parties. But it alleged that its signature on that agreement was forged. The English High Court issued an injunction to stop the proceedings in Malaysia until the authenticity of the signature had been decided by the English court. The judge claimed that the jurisdiction on the basis of the claimed jurisdiction on the basis that the oral agreement was made in English law. The other party had applied for a stay of proceedings in favor of arbitration, as it's entitled to under the New York Convention. And if the injunction was not granted, the instant proceedings would become duplicative. Of course, had he refused the injunction, it may well be that only the arbitration would have continued, and the arbitrators, in accordance with the agreement, would have then been the party and the appropriate body to determine whether or not the signature had been forged. Well, that's the anti-arbitration injunction. There's an overlap with the anti-suit injunction. But I'm going to look at that now because there is a substantive difference. Because anti-suit injunctions operate in personam. They are aimed at preventing or restraining proceedings in courts in breach of an arbitration agreement. They are typical when there are concurrent proceedings in another jurisdiction. The anti-suit injunction is not directed at a foreign court, but at the defendant who has promised through an arbitration clause or an exclusive jurisdiction clause not to bring foreign proceedings. Let me make 3 points about these anti-suit injunctions. First, the importance of the anti-suit injunction to the supervisory role of the national courts is by and large nowly widely recognized. These injunctions may have a vital role to play in the hands of national courts at the seat of arbitration. One vital question is whether it is appropriate for courts to award injunctions where it has not been seized and is not the seat of the arbitration. This was considered in one interesting case in Bermuda recently. The parties were involved in arbitration proceedings in Europe. And at that time, IPOC, one of the parties, began court proceedings in both New York and in Russia. The main question before the Bermuda Court of Appeal was whether it was entitled to grant an injunction to restrain a breach of an arbitration agreement on the basis that it had in personam jurisdiction over IPOC because it was a Bermudan company. Or was there some need for some other basis to claim jurisdiction? The Bermuda court rejected the argument that only the court at the seat of arbitration can issue an anti-suit injunction and held personal jurisdiction was sufficient. It then issued the anti-suit injunction to stop the court actions and send the parties to arbitration. While this decision is pro-arbitration and therefore welcome, one worries about the long-term implications of that type of acceptance of jurisdiction, because there could be situations where courts could unjustifiably interfere with the arbitration process merely because one of the parties is incorporated in its jurisdiction or has a place of business or for some other connecting factor. The second point on anti-suit injunctions is that national courts might arguably use the anti-suit injunction whenever they consider it necessary to protect the party's agreement to arbitrate. In this regard, the anti-suit injunction in the arbitration context is inherently different to injunctions awarded in other contexts. This is because of the very difference of arbitration itself. Other types of injunctions are issued in the context of wrongful or unconscionable conduct. In anti-suit injunctions, the court's concern ought to be to restrain a party from doing something other than it has promised to do, namely, to arbitrate. In this regard, the court ought not to be concerned by issues of oppressive or vexatious conduct, because the arbitration bites only because the parties have agreed to have their dispute resolved via a mechanism that transcends any individual jurisdiction, and courts ought to resist muddying the waters with other concerns. An interesting conceptual problem, which relates to the difference that I gave earlier about civil and common law systems, arises at the present time in the European Union. Regulation 44 of 2001, the Brussels Regulation, sets out jurisdiction, the rules for the jurisdiction of European courts. Article 27 of the Brussels Regulations provides that regardless of what the parties may have agreed, once a court within an EU member state has been seized with an action, no other court within the EU may interfere with the matter. This is lis pendens. It makes no difference how much bad faith is displayed by a party to the litigation proceedings in starting proceedings in another member state. It is for that member state to assume or decline jurisdiction depending upon where it is. There's currently a case before the European Court of Justice, referred to it by the House of Lords in England, called the West Tankers case. Here, an insured commenced London arbitration to recover excess losses from a collision at sea. During the course of the arbitration, the ship owner became aware that the insurers had commenced court proceedings against them in Italy. The English High Court granted an injunction to stop the insurers from continuing with the Italian proceedings on the grounds that under English law the duty to arbitrate was an inseparable part of the subject matter transferred, and the insurer was bound by the arbitration clause. How the Italian courts would react was an irrelevance. And in fact, the Italian court paid no attention to the English court decision. Well, we'll see how the European court will decide this matter, because an arbitration clause is dealt with differently under European law than an exclusive jurisdiction clause. Arbitration is expressly excluded from the scope of the Brussels regulations. The issue, however, is whether the term arbitration covers all matters relating to the arbitration, including the validity of the arbitration agreement, the establishment of the arbitration tribunal, incidental issues during the procedure, or does it relate only to procedural and enforcement matters? My third point, once again, is a word of caution. It is possible for national courts to misuse anti-suit injunctions. The greatest danger of such misuse is when they are granted post-arbitration award. That is, where they are employed by the courts of the seat of arbitration to protect an award that has already been made. Two recent cases in England, where the English courts have exercised its discretion to issue anti-suit injunctions to prevent a losing party challenging the award outside the jurisdiction in another country. This is on the basis, if you wish to challenge, you should do so at the seat of arbitration. One of these cases, an insured was entitled to granted an anti-suit injunction preventing an insurer from challenging a London arbitration award in the United States. The reason for the challenge in the United States was, and I don't know what the merit was, that the tribunal had ignored or had a manifest disregard of New York law, which was the applicable law to that contract. And most recently in the KBC Pertamina case, the U.S. Second Court of Appeals granted an injunction to prevent Pertamina from taking proceedings in the Cayman Islands to recover monies paid out under an award against it on the pretext that the award was procured by fraud, an attempt again to undermine the arbitration award. In my view, injunctions granted by these courts are inappropriate. Why? Because the arbitrators have the power and the ability to determine these issues themselves. And that is what the parties have agreed in their arbitration agreement. They have selected the they have selected arbitration as the forum in which their disputes are to be resolved. Thirdly, I turn to pro-arbitration orders. This is the final area that I wish to look at. These are orders issued by national courts for specific performance of arbitration agreements. On their face, they offer powerful support for the arbitration process because they directly compel parties to go to arbitration. The US law offers the greatest power in terms of ordering specific performance. Under the Federal Arbitration Act, a party aggrieved by the failure or refusal of a contracting partner to arbitrate under a written arbitration agreement can seek an order directing that such party participate in the arbitration as agreed. Failure to respect an order issued by a court could amount to a contempt of that court with the implications that follow from it. This type of order can have extremely important implications for default awards, as too often parties decide for tactical reasons, which may assist resisting enforcement, to refuse to participate in the arbitration despite the arbitration agreement. There is, however, some doubt as to whether this type of pro-arbitration injunction ought to appeal to those who support arbitration. Are they beneficial to the arbitral process? And do they accord with the core principles of arbitration practice? Well, in my view, most national laws do not expressly allow courts to order parties to participate in arbitration proceedings, even where there is a valid arbitration agreement. The New York Convention uses the term refer, as does the model law. The French Code requires a court to declare itself incompetent. The German procedure requires a court to declare the matter inadmissible. The Swiss law requires a court to decline jurisdiction. English law requires the court to stay the proceedings. None of them authorize an order that you go to arbitration. And in the Channel case some years ago, the English court was willing to make an order to stay proceedings, but was not prepared to order an injunction and make an order that the parties go to arbitration. Second, the stay of court proceedings brought in breach of an arbitration agreement might be indirect, but is nevertheless an efficient means of ensuring respect for an arbitration agreement while keeping court involvement to a minimum. It forces the claimant to go to arbitration because he has no other forum in which to bring his claim. Third, pro-arbitration agreements threaten the principle of competence, in that arbitrators could feel inhibited to reach a decision different to a national court that has compelled arbitration. The assumption would be, well, if a court has issued a pro-injunction order, it will have satisfied itself that there is a valid arbitration agreement. But of course, this isn't the case. It is still for the arbitral tribunal to take the primary decision. Fourthly, pro-arbitration injunctions threaten the sanctity of party autonomy, in that parties agree to go to arbitration on the basis that the party who believes itself to have been wronged initiates the arbitration. The arbitral agreement is not founded on the power of the courts to force a recalcitrant party to settle its disputes through arbitration. Well, my final question: what conclusions can we draw from all this? What's the answer to the question that I asked at the beginning of the evening? Does national court involvement undermine the international process? If only it was so easy to answer that. Let me give you some indications of how we can reach answers on this. First, national courts come in different forms: common law, civil law, developed and developing, legal systems with other political or religious influences. Despite its autonomous character, international arbitration depends on national courts to provide effectiveness, support and assistance for the process. International arbitration does not depend on national courts for its legitimacy. That exists as of right, based on the agreement of the parties, the New York Convention, and international arbitration practice. Accordingly, national courts should become involved where it is asked to give effect to the arbitration agreement, such as staying procedure, its proceedings where there is an arbitration agreement, establishing the tribunal, protecting and collecting evidence for the use in arbitration, and, if needed, the preservation of the status quo. When the arbitration is over, courts should seek to give effect to the tribunal's award, because it is a recognition of the autonomous character of arbitration, of the implied agreement of the parties that they would honor the award. That's why they agreed to go to arbitration. And because of the New York Convention, which under public law gave effect to the facilitating of enforcement. So far, so good. The real problem is with the interpretation of the arbitration agreement. This is the agreement for the ouster of the court's jurisdiction. And that's dependent on a valid arbitration agreement, or the extent of that agreement. Which is the best forum to determine this issue? Well, I would suggest this is the arbitral forum. Why? Because that's what the parties agreed. Arbitrators are able, and in fact it is their duty, to determine the scope of responsibility deputed to them by the parties. By contrast, national courts carry the baggage of sovereignty, of nationality, of perceived partiality, of perceived superiority, of a lack of understanding. And most importantly, they were rejected by the parties through the parties' choice of arbitration. As we've seen, injunctions are used as a weapon to support arbitration proceedings. But this, as I've illustrated, is largely in the common law world. We must therefore view it with great caution. The anti-suit injunction, which aims to restrain a party from resorting to a national court, are welcome. They support the arbitration process by directing the party to the forum in which they've agreed for their differences to be determined. The main focus in deciding whether to grant an injunction ought to be simply the party's agreement to settle their disputes by arbitration. These injunctions ought to be granted only by the seat of the arbitration and prior to an award being granted. The tribunal can then, as it is authorized to and in accordance with the doctrine of competence, determine its own jurisdiction. All injunctions have the capacity to be abused and to be used as a vehicle for mischief-making. If an injunction fails to reach its target It will not be respected by another court. And of greater concern, it could be a source of a second litigation front, which no doubt the parties would have wished to avoid, and it's exactly that that the arbitration agreement was intended to avoid. Most abusive are the anti-arbitration injunctions, which, while rare, are often for the specific intention of undermining the arbitration process. Here again, this is not a matter for the courts. If there is some reason the arbitration cannot or should not proceed, this should be determined by the method that the parties have chosen, by the arbitration tribunal. Pro-arbitration orders may well stem from good intentions, but they run the risk also of undermining the arbitration process by failing to recognize the self-correcting measures built into the arbitration system. An overzealous court is in clear danger of trespassing on the domain of the tribunal and or preempting a decision of such a tribunal. The safest course for a national court is to content itself with offering passive support by referring a matter to arbitration and recognizing the arbitration agreement. There is one very strong reason why national courts should stay away when parties have agreed on arbitration. It's not an easy one to state publicly, but it's a fact. There is an inevitable parochialism in every national court, whatever its brand of internationalism. International arbitration is a known system, its participants as lawyers, the arbitrators, the parties are inevitably hybrid or a mixture of forms and systems. They're brought together in the arbitration world. No national court can claim this breadth of international view and participation. Hence, the best thing is to stay out and leave it to the arbitrators. Of course, national courts do ultimately have the last laugh. They have the power of recognition and enforcement. Thank you very much.
I would like to thank you very much, Julian Liu, for having shared with us these thought-provoking, somewhat challenging ideas on the interaction of national courts. And we do have a present for Julian, but I can't find it. So somebody has to help me, you know. Must be somewhere.
Let's just join us for a reception.
Okay. And then we'll give you the present down there. Thank you very much, and please join us for our reception. Thank you very much.